All right, we are back with another episode of Colonial Outcast. This is part two of the new Israeli Civil War, secular liberal Israelis versus right-wing religious Judeans. And I've been getting some questions from the last one. No, that's not my, there we go. That's not my cactus in the back. It's not my cactus in the background. I'm house sitting. So anyways, if you listened to part one, great. If you're just a random dude who accidentally stumbled into a weird corner of the internet, welcome. Stay a while because you may have missed part one, but these episodes are standalone. Anyways, so we talked about the socio-cultural and political divides in Israeli society last episode within the context of political civil strife and internal violence regarding the hostages, the war in Gaza, and the potential recognition of Palestinian statehood. This second episode will focus heavily on the political aspects, both internal and external to Israeli society, and that could lead to a violent civil strife between the liberal metropolitan Israelis and the right-wing religious settler bloc of the society. Palestinian statehood may very well be the flashpoint. So for all you newcomers to the current state of affairs, here's what's going on. There's a genocide going on in Palestine, according to the United States definition of the term. The vaunted Western world is prepared to sacrifice the entire architecture of international law that has been put in place post-World War II, specifically to prevent there being another genocide like the Holocaust. They are prepared to tear it asunder so that Israel can continue to slaughter 250 Palestinians a day, the majority of whom are children, in order to accomplish their messianic vision of a greater ethno-supremacist Israel. We are throwing out the entire rules-based global order for the sake of a rogue colonial project that is the point of crisis our politics are at now. Anarchy and might makes right on the global scale. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us who recognize this to make a counter-narrative to challenge the absolute nonsense spewed by our politicians who only seek to enrich their paymasters and maintain their place in this appallingly corrupt and malfunctioning global order that we have. So now the question of Palestinian statehood is finally back on the table after being put into cold storage for years and years, and it's a thorny geopolitical issue. I mean, the recognition of a Palestinian state, be it eventually one state or two state, is the morally correct answer. However, it's going to be an absolute mess getting there. And to help us unthornify, which is, you know, not an actual word, this issue, Alina Xenofontos is coming on to help us unpack this. Now, I've read out her credentials a number of times on other episodes. Suffice to say, she is, though our series is new, a regular political analyst on this show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Greg, for having me again. It's a pleasure as always.
Excellent. So the basic premise of this discussion, as I see it, will be the UN General Assembly. The UN General Assembly wants to vote to potentially recognize a Palestinian state, which Israel desperately does not want. The U.S. supports Israel unconditionally thus far, but if the UN, which is essentially a U.S. construct, which gives America geopolitical legitimacy and influence around the globe, votes to recognize Palestine, then the United States will finally have to choose between its two children. Back Israel no matter what and damage the legitimacy and marginal effectiveness of the United Nations, or compel Israel to comply with the creation of a Palestinian state, which could lead to massive civil strife in Israel and lead to its inevitable colonial dissolution. So part one, we talked about the difference between the political difference between the liberal Tel Avivian Israelis and the more radical settlers. So the crux of last episode, we were talking about how like settler violence was done with the tacit acceptance of the police and the military, and some of the military personnel are settlers. So if the Israel is compelled to withdraw settlers and relocate them back to Israel proper so that a Palestinian state could actually be effectuated sometime in the future, those settlers may actually fight the government forces, and some of the government forces might actually join them. So we'll recontextualize that throughout the episode, but that was the crux of part one. Go back if you want to get more into it, but it's not necessary for what we're going to talk about. So That's where we are. There are other factors involved. Gulf states, for instance, coming in to form a coalition, Arab nation force that will run the security forces for Gaza, hypothetically, in the future after a ceasefire is called and Hamas doesn't remain in power, which I don't see as practicable or ever happening. But that's the conversation right now, which we'll get into. But I think we're just going to jump right in and start. So, Alina, you sent me this article a couple days ago by Ehud Olmert, which we talked about last episode. It was, if you guys aren't tracking, Olmert was a former prime minister of Israel from 2006 to 2009. And in this article in Haaretz, which is as left-wing as Israel gets in terms of news publications, it's not left-wing, but, you know, it's they do occasionally have some legitimate reporting. He asserted in the article, if you want to look it up, it's paywalled, but the Gaza's war's final scene and beyond, this is what Israel's endgame should be. I'm not going to go through the article again, but the salient points that he made and that was echoed in other editorials published in Haaretz on Israeli Independence Day, which was May 14th, yesterday at the time of this recording, basically saying similar things. They cannot defeat Hamas. They cannot get the hostages back without a diplomatic solution. They want an Arab coalition potentially to take control of Gaza security. And there is growing civil unrest about this issue and the question of Palestinian statehood that could lead to civil violence within Israel proper. So those were my salient points from what the former prime minister was saying about the political situation in Israel. If you'd like to expand on any of that before we jump in.
No, I think you covered that pretty well. It's just we have to now add to that basically, but we'll do that throughout the podcast really.
Yeah. So looking at the notes that you sent me before, we wanted to talk on, in this episode more about the question of Palestinian statehood than the civil strife potentially happening in Israel. So there's a lot of misconceptions on the West. There's this overriding narrative that the Palestinians were offered statehood, but Yasser Arafat walked away. And then that's not just in the conservative media that they use to justify the ongoing violence in Gaza, but we also see it in the coastal liberal media like CNN and MSNBC. And the video that we wanted to reference was Hillary Clinton on MSNBC 5 days ago saying how, you know, the students don't know what's going on. It's the Middle East is too complicated to understand. And we just wanted to apologize first and foremost of exposing you to this level of quote unquote journalism, but it's in microcosm, the entire false narrative that's being pushed about the idea of Palestinian statehood from the West. So this is Hillary Clinton and some sycophantic MSNBC TV host. I'm going to play this as long as I can stand it and comment intermittently because I can't just stay silent when I hear this crap. All right, here we go.
Oh, no, completely. I'm on the same page.
Yeah.
The stupidity of the slogans that ignore all the history since 1948.
Yeah, the slogan being from the river to the sea, which was actually created by the far right Likud party from the Jordan to the Mediterranean. You know, the same party that Benjamin Netanyahu is a part of. So from the river to the sea actually doesn't come from the idea of Palestinian statehood, but from the idea of and quest for Jewish supremacy.
Zionism. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
About what the United States has tried to do, about what you tried to do, about what President Clinton tried to do in bringing a two-state solution about. I remember when you talked about a two-state solution and it was considered radical. They couldn't believe, oh my God, Hillary Clinton actually is talking about a two-state solution.
First of all, the two-state solution was just always a talking point to give the veneer of progress on Palestinian liberation, but to actually just put it into a holding pattern so that it could be shelved in cold storage and then brought out intermittently whenever they needed to.
The thing is, the way he's presenting it's as though that is somewhere, it's sort of like Bill Clinton was the one to inaugurate the concept of two-state solution. I mean, that has been pretty much the premise since 1948, where they sort of drew up the lines and decided to set up Israel anyway. So I don't understand why they're acting like this is some sort of radical idea. I mean, it's completely ridiculous.
No, I mean, we have memos from 1947 from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA talking about the partition between Israel and Palestine. So it's nothing new. Yeah. But to continue.
He hates Israel. And now that's been flipped to you're a war criminal. Madeleine Albright's a war criminal.
They are.
Clinton's a war criminal.
Joe they are.
It's
they are
disgusting.
And she's of the worst, actually.
Yeah. And first of all those people were friends and buddies with Henry Kissinger. And if you're buddies with Henry Kissinger, you're likely a war criminal. But
oh yeah, I come from Cyprus. We know a lot about Henry Kissinger, so it is what it is.
Yeah, we might have to do a whole episode on him because his influence is so wide reaching. So many years later, after he's no longer been.
Several episodes on him. Several episodes on him.
So let's be on the scope of this one.
Tell us what needs to be done, what you would hope would be done. One, number two, how do we get Madeleine Albright's name on that building? Because she's been slandered in death. She's
good.
Been slandered in death. A public servant who escaped the Holocaust, gave her entire life to the United States of America, and has been slandered in death by extremists. I'm sorry, funded by
extremists.
Qatar.
Okay, so apparently we're both extremists funded by Qatar. I don't know why some Americans pronounce it Qatar. It drives me crazy. But anyways, I think if I was funded by Qatar, I wouldn't be so stressed about making rent. I'm just saying.
I'm 100% with you on that, you know, and most of us wouldn't be also losing jobs and job opportunities in the process. But okay, sure, okay.
Yeah, apparently those students who are protesting, taking on ruinous lifelong student debt, are also funded by the Gulf states. Huh.
Uh-huh. We're all funded by the Gulf. I mean, I'm still trying to pay off my debt, but okay, my student debt, you know, I'm still trying to manage that. But, you know, we're either Hamas operatives or funded by Qatar, or, you know, at some point they even tried to say it was a Putin conspiracy. They also said that the pro-Palestinian protests were Putin orchestrated. This is at the beginning. This was the beginning, like in October or September. Not September, what's it called? November. So that was another thing. So basically, we're all funded by someone.
Oh, yeah.
That's an enemy of the U.S.
Oh, yeah. Apparently, I think this guy brings China into it, too. Let's see.
And number three, I told you we were moving past therapy session. And number three, maybe this will get on YouTube if the communist Chinese will allow it to get on YouTube.
What?
Please
see, there it is.
Tell any students watching what President Clinton and you put together in 2000 in the Oslo Accords. You gave the Palestinians a pathway to peace, and they were scared to take it because they knew they would be slaughtered by Hamas.
Okay, first of all, the level of sycophancy, to me, it hurts my soul. Also, the idea that Hamas... a group of, you know, a couple thousand, a few tens of thousands of fighters could slaughter millions of people in the Palestinian
state.
When
he's speaking of the Oslo Accords, and in 2000, when the Intifada began, Hamas was pretty much like a non-contender. I mean, they were around, but they weren't really a significant player until 2000, after pretty much the second Intifada in 2005, then obviously after the elections. Like, they weren't really a significant player at the time. So I don't know what the hell he's on about. Hamas was going to kill everyone.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it'd be impressive if, you know, 10,000 people could kill like 5 million. How many? I forget the population of Palestine, but that's just an absurd statement.
5.2 million.
Okay, so please, yeah. Hillary, please, the woman who's made such great foreign policy decisions, please educate us. Uh-huh.
Wow, I don't know where to start, Joe, but you
go ahead. Yeah,
that's okay, exactly how I feel, Hillary. I don't know where to start. You know,
I want to make a couple of quick points because you raised, things that, need to be vented about. First of all, I have had many conversations, as you have had, with a lot of young people over the last many months now.
Doubt it.
And you're right. They don't know very much at all about the history of the Middle East, or frankly, about history in many areas of the
ignorant world,
including in our own country.
First of all, we're not ignorant, so ignorant of history that we don't know that she voted for the Iraq War or was the main champion of the regime change war in Libya, because, you know, she has
Secretary of State at the time.
Yeah, she has a kink for regime changes, and she was also the most vocal person in the White House Situation Room calling for a no-fly zone over Syria so we could shoot down Russia, shoot down Russian aircraft and, you know, start World War III.
Let's but just like, go straight to war with Russia, yeah.
Yeah, but keep cooking, Hillary. We're listening. Tell us about what we don't know.
But with respect to the Middle East, they don't know that under the Israelis and the Palestinians by my husband, the then Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, the then head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, then the Palestinian Authority, Yasser Arafat, an offer was made to the Palestinians for a state.
She's not going to bring up the offer. Let's not get into the nuances of this.
Okay, yeah, okay. First of all, for someone who's been a seasoned political operative and a public figure who's done hundreds, if not thousands, of televised interviews, she does, when talking about this subject, say, a lot.
Where's the media training?
Yeah, where's the media training? It's just like you so don't have a position that you're just saying, list name, list historical event. List another name.
Generic statement, no details, what the offer was, why it didn't work out, nothing. It's just that we made an offer and they refused, so it's on them because Hamas was going to come after them. It's so infantilizing to the audience as well. I mean, the way that she delivers this information.
Yeah, so I guess where would you like to start with this, the question of Palestinian statehood, how it could lead to a flashpoint within Israeli domestic and civil society?
Okay, so one of the reasons I think this particular talking point with Hillary Clinton is so important is because in the article that you just referenced and the one that I had sent to you is that Olmert, if I'm pronouncing his name wrong throughout this, please forgive me. But anyway, so he, in his article, he basically states that due to the current war, the genocide, the brutality behind it, and pretty much the global condemnation and the global public uprising, the public uprising in support of the Palestinian cause has completely changed the status quo. And he's speaking towards the fact that if we continue down this path and this war doesn't end, we're going to basically meet Israel's demise. So what he's saying is that we have to bring an immediate end to the war, and we have to sort of reorganize the state in order to combat the very fact that at some point he believes, and we're going to get into that, that according to him, he knows for a fact that there are some states that are going to take to the United Nations General Assembly the option of voting for a Palestinian state as a full state, to recognize the Palestinian state unilaterally. Whereas up until this point, for the most part, it's never gone through the United Nations General Assembly, and any discussion with regard to the Palestinian state was contingent to Israel accepting it, which is absolutely bizarre, the fact that the colonial power has a right to state whether a country can be free of them or not. That's even a violation of international law. But anyway. And so what he's basically stating is, how do we combat that? So I think you pretty much covered the division within Israel, and the fact that a lot of the factions, different factions within Israeli society, would obviously have big issue with accepting a Palestinian state. So what he proposes is very much in alignment with what Bill Clinton had outlined, the so-called deal that Hillary Clinton's talking about. And what he basically says is that to secure as much territory for Israel when a Palestinian state is going to be established, or if it's going to be established, because this is where this is what the trajectory is looking like at the moment, is by sort of abusing the settlers within the territories, whether it's in East Jerusalem or in the West Bank. And what he's basically stating is that essentially, where there is the majority of the settlers, where the majority of the settlers are located, should basically be given to Israel, annexed by Israel. And where there are smaller population sizes of settlers within Palestinian territories, should be moved into the larger, the more populous region of the settlers, and that they should therefore do so in order to take over as much territory essentially as possible, and not to dishearten those that are more orthodox in their approach and will refuse to leave, period. So sort of to minimize any sort of civil conflict between the different groups. And this is actually very similar to what Bill Clinton had actually proposed at the time. But before I get into that, I don't know if you want to make a comment, because I was going to sort of get into what they had actually even proposed, what Bill Clinton had proposed, and how he's basically advocating for the same thing, which is complete subjugation of the Palestinian people and taking more of their territory until essentially don't even have a state, a land, or much of land anyway to establish a state.
Well, a lot of these illegal settlements were established specifically to prevent Palestinian statehood. Ariel Sharon described them as, you know, because if you look at the ghettoization of the West Bank, basically turning population centers of Palestinians into small ghettos that were not adjacent or not connected to each other, so there's limited freedom of movement, they would weave these illegal settlements in between these Palestinian ghettos to where Ariel Sharon described it as, quote, a pastrami sandwich, so that no one, not the United States or the UN, could ever tear it apart. So in terms of the sovereignty of Israel.
Exactly. So, and they want to even now, they're even pushing, the reason they're even amping up the construct of placing even more settlements, which is, they've been very aggressive about it, even since October 7th, is in case there's ever sort of any discussion of a Palestinian statehood, that would automatically wipe it out, because they will use the settlers as ammunition to say, well, we need to take more territory. And in the bill, in the proposal that was given in this incredibly synopsized version by Bill Clinton, there were three so-called parameters at the time. And the offer that was given to the Palestinians was essentially that they had to revoke their right to return. So they would never, they would not ever be allowed to return to what is Israel today, to claim a right of return. The second was that essentially wherever there are settlers, they would be governed by Israeli law, so that even if they would stay within the state of Palestine, it would, their Palestinian state and authority would be completely undermined, because they would be governed by Israeli law in a foreign essential state. And the third would be that there would be a transition period whereby the IDF would still be governing in Palestinian territories. So I think it was something like a, was it 2 years? I might not remember that accurately. And then in fact, then In order to sort of counter the fact that, okay, well, we don't want, the Palestinians obviously didn't want Israel to be governing parts of their territory because of the settlers, the whole idea was that, okay, then we're going to annex those territories where the settlers are based, giving it to Israel. In exchange, the Israelis will be giving Palestinians a bit of land. However, they fail to specify what that land would be, where it would be located, how much that would be, whereas the Palestinians already knew how much of their territory was going to go over to Israel, but that the amount that was going to be given to the Palestinians was never secured. And in fact, there was a letter that was written to Bill Clinton by Yasser Arafat, who had actually said, listen, I can't go ahead and accept something like this because we haven't secured the right of return. Okay, even if we revoke that and say we accept that, how are our people going to be compensated? What land and territories are we going to get back? And he obviously had a particular issue with having the IDF in a Palestinian state, because obviously that would undermine and possibly create conflict within the Palestinian territories that then Israel could exploit for itself. So Olmert is kind of proposing something similar. He said, we need to basically accumulate as many settlers in where there's a vast majority to annex that territory, and we'll give the Palestinians something back, but we need to become efficiently organized with regards to how the settlers are going to be laid out in order to appropriate even more land if ever a Palestinian or a two-state solution goes through, basically leaving Palestinians with very little to nothing.
Right. And one of the biggest issues, and it's still an ongoing conversation, is that if a Palestinian state exists, it's going to be demilitarized. The Palestinians are not allowed a military. So, we're talking about the arming of fanatics, as well as like right-wing Jews who are in the military and police who could orchestrate organized violence to prevent even the creation of a Palestinian state, leading to what we've said is a civil war that could destroy the entire country, et cetera, et cetera. Also, they couldn't allow the Palestinians to be armed. Don't know how they're going to make that happen after Hamas has explicitly won. But there is a talk, and it's something we touched upon in like January that I've been talking about in December, and some people even before that, how they're going to try to get a coalition of other Arab states to be the de facto security force for Palestine in the eventuality of the creation of the Palestinian state. Because again, Palestinians can't be armed. So they're going to get our strategic allies like Egypt and Jordan and certain Gulf states to send in security forces. And, you know, from my military experience, I know about how like what it's like to work with a coalition force. It's an absolute mess. The chain of command screwed because you're working with different players from different systems. And not only that, it's just a clear attempt to give the United States legitimacy and Israel legitimacy in its policy to continue to subjugate the Palestinians. Because it's like, oh, we have, you know, Arab allies assisting us, and they're the ones policing other Arabs. But of course, it doesn't take into account that Egypt, Jordan, and the Gulf states are like our strategic allies in the region. And some of them want to normalize with Israel because there's a lot of money to be made with like the new Dubai and the redevelopment of Gaza and a bunch of other things. So, yeah, that was one of his big points, bringing this Arab coalition force in there. But I don't see how mm-hmm. that's even workable.
Yeah, and then we saw just yesterday came out the documents that were revealed for Gaza 2035, right, which kind of said pretty much the same thing. So Netanyahu's approach right now is to create that sort of coalition of these different, the Gulf states or the states of the region that you said that will monitor Gaza, transfer the power to them. And then apparently they're going to they're going to make Gaza into an energy hub that they're then going to use to counter apparently Russian, China influence, aka the BRI and all the trade routes in the region. Now, this to me is not feasible because, first of all, again, we're assuming the fact that you've completely subdued the Palestinian resistance, which according to those documents you would have to do, as in apparently get rid of Hamas. But as we said, Hamas is an idea. It's a Palestinian resistance, and the Palestinians will not stop until they have their liberation. They're not going to continue, especially after a genocide, to live as a colonized, occupied population, energy hub, no energy hub, and have the United States and the Arab Gulf states sort of governing them. But I love how, by the way, in this piece, Olmert, he kind of also says, you know, we'll transfer the Palestinians over to like a new Palestinian authority that's going to be, you know, by the sort of co-governed by these Gulf states, but they will have the final say to who governs them. I think like the pseudo aesthetic level democratic elements that he puts through to show like, you know, we Israelis do actually care about the Palestinians. It's always too much.
Trying to pretend like the Palestinian Authority isn't viewed as collaborators by the majority of Palestinians.
Exactly. And that's the thing. So there's that. And then there's obviously the fact that we've discussed before, and I obviously don't want to reiterate too much and sound repetitive, but the fact that a lot of these Gulf states also do have their strategic interests and financial interests now with Russia and China and the BRI and BRICS. So creating this so-called energy hub is also going to be countering their relations with these two other emerging superpowers, particularly that of China. And it's not going to be so, okay, yes, we're going to work with the United States, because the United States is no longer the superpower that it was. It no longer lies in their interest, economically speaking, because you're seeing that China is, I mean, from the PPP perspective, they are the industrial superpower of the world right now, and they're consistently growing. It doesn't serve you to counter an emerging superpower that you're also part of, you know, the BRICS alliance with now as well. So it's not going to be so clear cut that, yes, we're going to allow this union of these Gulf states to govern or co-govern Gaza. It's not going to be easy from that angle, from the angle of self-interest, geopolitics, but also from the perspective of the Palestinian people. And of course, internally, what's going to be how these, you know, Egypt, for example, how their people are going to respond to aiding and abetting Israel and the United States objectives in Gaza. It's not going to sit well with the local population. So I don't think that this is something that's sustainable.
Right. I mean, it seems progressive from an Israeli perspective, this entire editorial, but there's just so many glaring issues going on. His idea generally, in addition to this coalition government, is to, as you wrote, get rid of Netanyahu and create a unified government that will bring together a segregated Israeli society, which we touched on last episode, as this will be paramount if Palestine is unilaterally recognized and as such codified under international law. A strong government will be requisite in order to enter negotiations with Palestinians. Well, as we know, Bibi's government is, you know, completely composed but through his power base on the far right. You know, he's mobilized and aligned himself to extremists like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who he used to prop himself up, but now who he's beholden to as this war in Gaza goes on. They've said, you know, if a ceasefire is signed, they will leave government and he will be isolated from the main political power blocks that he relies on. So I don't see like how this idea of a strong, unified government ever coming into existence being a real thing, because who's he going to get replaced by? Yair Lapid, the opposition leader, who's not an opposition leader. Yeah, he's not an opposition leader to Netanyahu because he's some sort of leftist reformist. He's just a different type of crazy that Washington is willing to work with.
Exactly. They're basically going through a sort of change of face, and somebody who seems less radical publicly, because at this point, Netanyahu and his government, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who are just coming across as completely, insane. And the way that they're presenting, the way that they're so openly stating that we will never allow for a Palestinian state to exist. And this has sort of become the main slogan right now of the Israeli state. What the U.S. wants and what Olmert is sort of advocating for is sort of a revamp, where basically we're going to bring in the same sort of individuals, the same sort of personas with the same sort of objectives, where they're not going to allow for a Palestinian state to exist. However, they're going to change the diplomatic approaches to doing so. However, that's sort of what he's saying. But at the core of it, one of his main concerns, as we'll see in this article and what he's focused on, is because of the public uprising and because of the political pressures now to establish a Palestinian state, he believes that this is actually something that's now plausible. In the context of, as he said, he believes that there's going to be states that are actually going to put through the United Nations General Assembly a vote by which to decide whether to unilaterally recognize a Palestinian state. And as he said, God forbid that happens, the status quo will be completely changed, because if this resolution passes, and yes, it will have to go to the United Nations Security Council, he's saying if it goes to the United Nations Security Council, the United States might actually be under pressure to either abstain or vote in favor of a Palestinian state. And that's why he's saying we need to become organized now, that we need to have a government that at the very least can negotiate with a Palestinian state to take as much territory from them and not lose the borders that they've secured since 1967. And I think what is most important here is why he has that fear and how legitimate is that fear.
So what's your assessment on that? Like, is it a legitimate fear that the U.S. would abstain from a vote on Palestinian statehood? Because as I said at the beginning of the episode, they might be forced to choose between the long tradition of unconditional support for Israel or to vote against the U.N. General Assembly and kind of undermine the U.N., its legitimacy and its geopolitical clout, which would hurt U.S. interests globally. So.
Yeah. Exactly. So his verdict is that the United States will abstain or vote in favor of. I'm of the belief that they probably won't. Maybe they might abstain, but they will definitely vote in favor of a Palestinian state if countries do put the question forward to the United Nations General Assembly. If that question goes forward in the United Nations General Assembly, I do believe overwhelmingly there will be a vote recognizing the Palestinian state. And it's important to understand, and I think you mentioned this in your intro, that although decisions made or resolutions passed at the United Nations General Assembly are non-binding, they do form part now of international law known as jus cogens or customary law, which means now internationally there is a resolution that has been accepted that becomes an accepted legal norm that Palestine is now an official full state recognized by all global states, let's just say. So even if it goes to the United Nations Security Council, and let's just say the United States rejects it, this is where it gets very interesting. If the United States was to reject that proposal, at the same time, the United States has codified in their legal system, it's something called Public Law 1990. I think it's Public Law 101246. And under Section 414, it explicitly states that the United States will stop funding any organization or institution, and it even stated the United Nations by name, if they were to provide full member status to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or basically any Palestinian authority or anyone that represents the Palestinian people. So they've codified in their own legal system to withdraw money and funds to even the United Nations if any state will give them full status. So if the United Nations General Assembly puts this vote forward and votes in favor of, this would directly violate the US law and put the United States in a position where they would actually have to withdraw funding from the from institutions in the United Nations. And they have already done that in the past. They did it in 2011 with Obama, where basically the United Nations Education, Scientific and Cultural Organization, also known as UNESCO, if that's how you pronounce it. Basically, they had actually given the Palestinian people full membership in that institution, and the Obama administration had completely withdrawn all funds and actually was no longer a member of that institution. From 2017 onwards, it completely withdrew. And there was a lot of conversation at the time as to how UNESCO had to actually pull funds and try to accumulate as much money as possible, which was more difficult for them in order to sustain themselves. And the United States only rejoined UNESCO in 2023. And the reason why, and this is where it gets interesting, because China was now becoming one of the key funders, which meant that they were asserting influence in a UN institution. And the UN, again, was created by the US as a political tool for their own foreign policy around the world.
Yeah, so you wrote that this matters that insofar as like the U.S. pulling its funding from its own institution, this matters as the U.N. is the birth child of the U.S. as a means to assert its imperialism around the world. If they withdraw funding from their own institutions, which are nothing more than tools for American foreign policy, this would cost the U.S. and its global hegemony. So system in a cascade failure where, you know, if Palestinian statehood is voted for, the U.S. has put laws in place to kind of self-destruct its own system. It's like, okay, we're threatening the rest of the U.N. essentially, I'm trying to break it down as easily as possible, we're threatening the U.N. to withdraw our funding and therefore material support for the United Nations if Palestinian statehood is recognized. However, that's self-destructive because that same institution is what we use to project global hegemony. So what to do? This is a political mess for like Israel and the United States and everybody involved.
But that's also why Olmert is so terrified. This is why you're getting a lot of pieces coming out of Haaretz now. It's sort of apocalyptic. You know, this could be the end of Israel. Israel going to make it up to its 100 years, because there is a real... there's a real scenario where the US is really going to have to stop supporting Israel, because it's going to get to a point, if we continue, the international pressure continues, it's going to get to a deadlock where essentially the United States is going to have to pick between Israel, sustaining Israel, and between its own institutions. And if I was the United States, I would pick my own institutions. So that is why now they're trying to essentially, what he's advocating for, and I think what the United States is trying to do in the back, in the, you know, behind the scenes, is to revamp the image of Israel. And Netanyahu has to go, and his government has to collapse. And that's why he says we need a unified front, because at this particular point, because as I also made a point of referencing, I mean, Joseph Borrell, which is, for people that don't know, for example, he's sort of the United Nations foreign policy minister. So he's like the face of the EU. He was basically came out and said that 9 EU countries now are going to be basically recognizing Palestine unilaterally on the 21st of May. He suspects by the 21st of May, but it's not 100% secure, but he specifically said the 21st of May, which is just a matter of days away now. This again is another bold step. You've got the EU, which is a Western ally, a US ally, who is now openly stating they're emphatically pushing towards a two-state solution. Now, they obviously have their own agenda here. It's not because they care about the Palestinians, but they're emphatically calling for a two-state solution. They're unilaterally calling for, for a two-state solution, the recognition of Palestinian statehood. And right now, the United States is looking more and more like the only entity alongside Israel who's rejecting that and who's basically supporting Israel. So it's going to isolate the United States even further. And this is sort of the international political pressure we're talking about. They either are going to have to take a stance where they're regaining their role as sort of the leader of the so-called free world, or they're going to collapse with Israel.
Yeah, so it's a true existential crisis. I mean, we continue to be isolated politically more and more. I do think like some things have helped repair the United States image in terms of its people and not its government. And that's been like the massive unrest and the student protest movement, but that's a different thing. So yeah, the government seems, the United States government seems completely unworkwithable. Also not a word, but you know, when other countries look at this irrational behavior, how the United States is sabotaging its own institutions, how it's backing Israel no matter what, in spite of its own global security interests, who would you rather work for? An actor that's doing all this crazy stuff, or China and to some extent Russia, who are just kind of staying the course? You know, when they say something, they generally mean it. They have a completely different, you know, they're not doing this double talk on international news about, you know, what their stated value system are. And that's completely controverted by their actions with regards to the war in Gaza. It's like, who would you choose if you're a burgeoning economy and country in the global South? Would you choose a bad actor, an unstable actor like these Western countries typified by America, or something like China, which is very stable Belt and Road Initiative? You get what you pay for and you generally get what you sign up for. So that's one thing that's going on as well.
Yeah, of course. And this is why I also say when they discuss the 2035 Gaza objective and having these goal states come together to mutually govern Gaza, I mean, again, that's very far-fetched. I mean, by 2035, I don't even know how the state of Israel will exist and be by that time. I'm just being very honest. But these states looking at the state of Israel right now, looking at the state of the United States as well, are less inclined to want to align with the United States. They're going to want to. This is another reason why I do not see this project going forward. And I have to say as well, like when, because I spoke about the EU, also has its own self-interest in pushing for a two-state solution. They will not allow for Israel to take more and more territories and completely obliterate the Palestinians. From their perspective as well, a two-state solution preserves Israel and their influence in the region. But at the same time, the EU has a huge migrant crisis because of all these wars, whether it's our interventions in Libya, Syria, the fact that we said before that Libya was a buffer for the American continent to the EU. And since that collapsed, since Gaddafi fell, all the doors flushed open into the EU, who has its own economic crisis because of the EU sanctions against the energy coming from Russia, which is pretty much economic suicide committed by the EU. And if we now continue to push in this sort of, if we allow Israel to continue on the trajectory that it is, the EU will again ultimately pay the price, because when you have all these refugees, which are going to exasperate significantly, and I think you had Hezbollah the other day, was it yesterday, Nasrallah was basically coming out and saying, he even made a statement to let all the Palestinians and all the Syrians, basically refugees, sort of go into Europe. And he even mentioned Cyprus in that. And there was a bit of a discussion here in Cyprus, like, oh, how dare he put Cyprus into that? I was like, well, Cyprus is the only Middle Eastern country in the EU. So yeah, come into Cyprus and then let them flood through the EU. And it was more so let them reap what they sow, essentially. And so the EU is now really trying to control this. And that's why they're also emphatically pushing towards a two-state solution in order to avoid any further exasperations that could occur if this situation continues within the region. So my belief is, and I will say this, if a country, if there really is talk behind the scenes, like the former prime minister of Israel has been saying, that somebody really wants to, that there's a nation state that's going to put this proposal forward to unilaterally vote at the United Nations General Assembly for Palestine to become a state, this will completely alter the status quo. And truthfully, the United States will be put in a very difficult situation. I think that this is going to coerce Israel to indeed have to negotiate with Palestinians. That is why they're running to deal with the settlers. That's why they're trying to use the settlers as ammunition. But this will cause internalized friction. And that is why I truthfully believe the very statehood of Israel will be brought to question. And I think at this point, with all these countries that are coming forward and saying we want to recognize Palestine unilaterally, this could very well be plausible, because we have never seen such international pressure right now for a Palestinian state as we're seeing today.
Exactly. And just to bring everything full circle, Israel, again, may be pressured to relocate settlers. And that's the flashpoint of this civil internecine violence that we're referring to. It's all about the settlers and the settlements, and how, if Palestinian statehood is going to be recognized and going to be put forward, it would take years to effectuate. And one of the starting pieces would have to be to give the settlers, you know, a choice to like either stay in Palestine, where, you know, there would be a different governmental structure, a different system of laws. If the Palestinians can't be militarized and have assault rifles, you guys might have to give up your guns too. And I know a lot of settlers came from Texas to, you know, enact their Wild West fantasies, and they're not going to want to give up their guns, and it's going to be an absolute mess. I'm not sure. This is kind of unprecedented. We look to precedents when trying to make predictions, but never seen this before, as you were saying, Alina, about, you know, this level of international pressure for Palestinian statehood. The past seven months have changed. The past 7 months have changed the entire global dynamic. It's incredible.
Yeah, I think it's like the article that I sent you when they were discussing. I think I sent it was from Fox News, and it was sort of like a professor. I can't remember her name. She was obviously Jewish herself and Israeli American, and she was basically stating, with regards to the legislation that was even codified in the U.S. that basically attaches their funding, or even the United States, to the very existence of Israel, which is insane. She had actually said that the United States never thought, this is a direct quote, that they would have that things would have reached this level. So when they put this into legislation, I don't think they ever thought that there would be, and I don't know why. I don't know what would make them think that this would, you know, that the status quo would continue, you know, a colony would continue to exist without any sort of retaliation. But they never thought that we would reach this particular point where there would be such emphatic pressure for a Palestinian state, so when they put this into legislation. So I agree, this is very unprecedented, given even the way that they approached their own legislation. It's kind of very clear.
Yeah, well, it's a mess. So I think that this is kind of where we're gonna wrap up part two of the Civil War. First was the internal strife. Second is the external political dissolution and predicament that Israel and, by extension, the United States are in. So when is the UN General Assembly supposed to vote on Palestinian statehood?
To become a member state or to vote. It hasn't gone through yet. This is what I'm saying. It's conversations that are coming out of Israel. And what's his face? I'm sorry, I keep forgetting his name. Olmert, the former prime minister. Yeah. He's saying that behind the scenes, he knows for a fact that there's a lot of countries that are considering putting it through. Up until this point, they've avoided doing it because it would be a huge, major political confrontation. But the fact that essentially it looks like he believes, or he knows for a fact, and this is somebody who's obviously involved in the political scene. He's a former prime minister. He has the contacts, and he says he knows this for a fact, that this is being discussed. It's very telling. And this is why he's in Haaretz. And this is why we're seeing all these articles coming out of Haaretz that are really calling, we need to end this war effective immediately, and we need to reorganize, because they're seeing that the more they're pushing, the more extreme things are becoming, and the more the extremity is calling for global action that will see this put through. But hasn't yet gone through. This is why, again, this is all very hypothetical, but I do think that it's very crucial that this is coming out of Israeli media and the former prime minister, who's saying that he knows for a fact, this is what he says in the article, that this is being discussed and that this could be something that could be proposed. And you never know. You could even be someone like China, because if I was China, I'm just going to put it like this. If I was China, hell, I would have even proposed it. Let's propose it. Let's see where this is going to go. Let's watch the United States pull out their funding of the United Nations, which they would never do. China would come in and swoop that up. They're also doing the same thing with the International Monetary Fund. This is how China is securing itself and eliminating the United States. It's very strategic. It's very smart. But I can see this as being a form of checkmate. I mean, it could very well be that checkmate.
Yeah. So I hope this was helpful for some of y'all listeners. I keep getting comments like, you know, it's kind of hard to like wrap your head around like these kind of broad dynamics that exist across the globe. And all I can say is I get you. I know the past 7 months have been a crash course in a lot of things for a lot of people. And I studied international relations. I know it can take some time to internalize how this all works, years, but keep at it. And, you know, you're going to get it eventually, hopefully. And we're still learning. Everyone's still learning. So this was our prediction about, you know, the potential strife that's going to go down both internally and externally to Israel based off of this horribly misguided genocide campaign in Gaza that's having global repercussions for decades to come. So I think that's where we're going to leave it. And thank you so much, Alina, for coming on yet again. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me again and listening to my little rants as per usual. I try to like tone it down so I don't drive you too crazy and the audience too crazy, but thank you as always.
No, I love a good rant and thanks so much for coming on. We will post this as soon as possible. Our next episode, hopefully releasing this Sunday, is going to be about a memorandum from the Joint Chiefs from 1947. It doesn't exist in open source, so we had to hire a bunch of researchers from a guild that sweeps the National Archives, and they pulled boxes, and they found some documents from post-war 1947 before the creation of the State of Israel from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That will be Sunday, and we're going to be breaking that down. So hot. That's going to be the hot topic. So hope to see you guys then. And thanks so much for listening. Cheers.